OT After Dark is a podcast run by two occupational therapists and is for adults only. The views on this podcast are our own and are intended for information and educational purposes only. We believe that sex and sexual pleasure are a human right for consenting adults, regardless of ability, age, gender, or sexual orientation. We discuss topics that cover a wide variety of sex and sexual practices. To be true to our strong views regarding inclusivity, we use common and slang terms regarding sexual topics, which may be considered explicit. Listener discretion is advised.
We have exciting news to share. We recently partnered with DirectRec, a free app for OT practitioners, PT practitioners, and speech-language pathologists.
DirectRec helps clinicians to find peer-vetted products, and we recently have added our own recommendations of products on DirectRec for sexual health and wellness.
We helped DirectRec get a little extra sexy. DirectRec helps clinicians share products and other digital info, like YouTube videos and Google Docs, with their clients.
DirectRec helps you to track clients' follow-through on your product recommendations. So to start using DirectRec, click on the link on our website at otafterdark.com or in our social media bios.
Hi, I'm Kay.
And I'm JJ.
And we're both occupational therapists.
And we're here talking to you about sex.
Woo!
And we just got back from the Society for the Study of Occupation conference in Scottsdale, Arizona.
An amazing time. A hot time.
It was and we got to talk about BDSM.
We sure did.
It was phenomenal.
A room full of researchers.
Yes. Educating about the joys of communication and BDSM when you have disabilities.
Excellent.
So this is a very, very fun episode because OT After Dark is going global.
Another conference. We found another hotel bar because where else do you record at an OT conference? We had the pleasure of talking to Karen McCarthy from the United States, Owen Gorman from Ireland, and Rebecca Twinley from the United Kingdom about all things sex, their research related to sexuality, how they teach sexuality in their respective programs, and we probably a few tangents in there.
Yeah.
There was wine involved.
Yeah, which, you know, it's the best way to have these conversations.
That's how we roll.
You know.
So sit back and take a listen to this episode of OT After Dark.
So we are here in Scottsdale, Arizona at the Society for the Study of Occupation conference. We have a lovely panel here with us today from all over the globe here, which is a fantastic benefit to being at this conference. You get to network and talk to people from all over the globe.
So if everyone who wants to fully introduce themselves, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Sure. I'm Karen McCarthy. I currently teach at Dominican University of California and teach psychosocial mental health, but I also have a private practice in data coaching.
All right.
Hello, my name is Owen Gorman. I'm from University College Cork in Ireland. I'm the program director down there, and I also teach psychosocial OT. I'm doing my PhD in the lived experience of transgender people.
I'm Bex Twinley. I'm from the UK, currently at Plymouth, soon to be Brighton University, and interested in talking about sex.
All right.
Yay!
Yes, everybody's here.
So we have a table full of educators. Can we talk about how you incorporate sex, sexual expression, sexuality, dating, all of that into curriculum?
Well, I start with talking about sexuality and all that goes into that. So dress, gender identity, mm-hmm. sexual orientation, sexual activity, and I actually do use doing dress articles at Goodman et al.
Yeah.
And I feel like that spurs on, even though it's a very not risky article in a way, it gets people talking about things like gender identity and dress and kind of that construction of who you are as a sexual being. So I do use that.
So, you know, we have a specific class, or I have a specific class on sexuality, specifically focusing on gender and gender identity, but then also getting into sex as an occupation.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things actually we do at the beginning of the class is we play a clip from The Little Mermaid. right? So
Don't
be shy. I have to say,
kiss the girl. Where we go?
Actually, I got this idea from the last SSO conference I was at 2 years ago. I was talking to an OT from there, and they were telling me that this is something that they do. So I stole it.
I might steal it. Tell me more.
So you know the song. You know when the little mermaid goes to the witch to trade her voice. So we play that song, and it's Poor Unfortunate Soul. So I actually play the song, but we put up the lyrics so that the students can actually either sing along but see what's being said, and the message that is being sent across to young children. So there are certain lines in it, like men up there don't like girls who blather or who blabber. That's what it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They think that girls who talk are a bore. So basically she's saying that it doesn't matter if you think or you talk or you speak, you have body language, you have beauty, that is your worth, right? And then I looked more into it then online. Actually, there's a great website called Bitchflix, which does a feminist critique of movies.
Mm-hmm.
So within that as well, also the music that is used within The Little Mermaid. So, and even the color and the imagery. So Ursula is dark and she's very masculine. So again, that idea.
And voluptuous,
yes.
And not the best looking.
Yeah, based on a drag queen though. As well,
yeah.
The character,
yeah, big nice.
And the music that accompanies her apparently is quite masculine, right? So you're getting into all these kind of things about like the masculine kind of oppression of the Little Mermaid and losing her voice, you know, and even like I think there was something done about how many minutes Ariel actually speaks in the whole of the movie, and she's meant to be the main character.
Wow.
So we begin with this idea about like the things that you're learning and consuming through media. And there's a really good documentary called Misrepresentation that goes into that so much further.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the students are then encouraged to watch that. And then we look at the idea of toys, and we put up the pictures of like the aisles of toys and toy shops.
Mm-hmm.
And all that. We get into all that kind of stuff. And then into the occupations of how they reinforce create gender. And then we get into actual sex as an occupation, and but more so about intimacy. So that's kind of the I went on a little bit more.
But
that's the kind of the core of what actually happens within that class.
Mm-hmm.
Now we draw on different elements from other parts of the module, but that's the specific class on sex and gender.
How far are they into the program when they get to that?
So this would be in the third year of a 4-year program.
Okay.
And it usually takes place in the first semester, roughly around I'll say 5-6 weeks into the semester. Yeah.
Okay.
But they're a strong cohort that they've been together for 3 years.
They've got that
class.
Comfort level.
So I think it's a good to think about like safety and comfort a bit with that. Yeah.
Yeah, and we've just developed trust within the class itself, you know.
Bex. Well, we don't, I would say we're pretty rubbish at addressing it. We use lots of problem-based learning where I'm at the moment and have tried to really kind of target, let's say, the kind of scenarios that we give to students so that they are addressing more than, you know, the very obvious aspects of people's lives. And in terms of gender, we definitely don't have any approach like that, so that's really nice to hear.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that. I'd quite like you to send that to me in an email.
No problem.
But yeah, so through scenarios where gender is an issue or sexuality, sexuality in the sense of orientation or kind of sexual practice, as it were, as well. So it's, I guess, less direct way at the moment than I'm used to.
I think that class is just really, like, to have a class talking about it is really important, and actually as a teacher to model the language, as in, like you guys do, to have a sense of humor and to use the actual language that's out there, and you're almost like practicing getting used
people
to
don't want
talking
serious
about
sex
no.
for the
yeah.
most part.
No.
I mean, I'm sure some people do, but generally speaking.
Only missionary. But and then I take like practice situations, like I do like a quiz too about like what makes you the most uncomfortable, like masturbation or polyamory or like a pedophilia or whatever it is, and then they make what's uncomfortable, and then I say, is anything on that list something that you've seen in field work? So like sharing a story.
Oh, I like
it.
That.
And I remember once a student went on field work and it was working with people who identify as having an intellectual disability, but she went to him and said, into his room, and she was like, oh, it's time to come for dinner. I was calling him for dinner, and he's looking at a magazine of like a girl. And she's like, oh, I don't know what to do in this situation. And I'm like, well, she's like, oh, I don't know if he, and I'm like, oh, did he come? And I'm like, come? Like, the whole class is like, come?
Valid question.
Yeah. So I was like, and then she was like, oh man, and everybody's laughing. I'm like, because that just changes the whole intervention. You have to call for
cleanup.
What are you going to do?
Yeah. the things people don't think about. But the more you talk, I think the more comfortable.
There's definitely, I think, using humor as a way to open up mm-hmm. that conversation definitely is a good way of opening up. Because there is a serious element too
yes,
as well when you get into
much.
The nitty gritty about it, like when you're trying to talk about something with a client and mm-hmm. it can be a very serious conversation. Mm-hmm. But the students who are going to be future practitioners need to be comfortable in themselves first.
Right.
Because if they broach the subject with the client and say, do you want to talk about your sex life?
Yeah.
They've created a space immediately saying, it's okay to talk about this.
And as students, I think they need to get past, we need to help them get past the giggle phase.
Yeah. Yes.
By the time they're
fine.
Done,
you know,
they
to
need to be,
laugh.
Yeah.
I've had this conversation with someone though, and about that issue, like how comfortable are students, but also, you know, how able are they to get past that?
Yeah.
Sex. But then you've got to kind of, you have to remember that a lot of our students come when they are just turned 18
mm-hmm.
or
yeah.
And if we all think back to that age, even if we think we were quite mature or experienced or whatever
yeah.
at that point, you know, maybe we were, but not every 18-year-old
yeah.
is. And actually, some of them are, they have every right to feel a bit
yeah.
Mm-hmm. about
like,
it.
Yeah.
And that's it. I mean, we're not fixing anything or making them grow up or force the maturity on them. We're just
no.
saying, look at this is something that could come your
absolutely.
Way. You've chosen
yeah.
this career. Let's have a discussion about it in a safe, but I don't want to say safe, but it is a safe space.
Safe space.
But it's also a space where they're able to experience that difficulty or that
mm-hmm.
awkwardness, but not to run away from it, to embrace it and move along with it. Like, we start off with just shouting out the word sex.
Yeah.
And saying it loud. And then
oh,
how
love
many...
That. You don't do the penis game?
No, we
what's
do. Like,
penis
oh,
game?
No, we do.
Penis game.
You just start yelling
penis?
It louder and louder.
Yeah.
Like,
that would be really interesting on my campus.
Kind of euphemisms or what are the slang words
yeah.
that they have about sex, you know, and I've learned different ones
yeah.
from them, and I teach them the ones that I knew when I was younger, and that, like my favorite one was getting vitamin D.
Yeah,
get
my vitamin
yeah.
D.
So. It's only good when you combine it with sun, though.
El fresco then comes up usually as well.
That's a nice way to tie in culture,
yeah.
slang, like, and then
definitely. And actually, there is a website that you can add all your own words about sex to it as well, and we share that with the students.
What website? Other
yeah.
than Urban?
I
mean, there's Urban Dictionary,
like,
but this is different
like,
than Urban Dictionary.
I'll find out and I'll send it on to you.
Yeah.
It is something like that. There is a website.
But it's specific to sex.
Yeah, this person just started making a list of all the euphemisms they've
yeah.
ever
there are
heard about
so
sex.
Many. Oh,
yeah.
I need that website.
Yeah.
So how are students... How are you finding your students are accepting this information and accepting the idea that sex is an ADL?
I mean, for me, they teach me a lot. Like, I taught a class on sexuality and dating. Oh, so that after the class, a student came up to me and said, because I was talking a lot about my research and practice with dating.
Yes.
And she said, you left out some people because what about asexual people?
Yeah.
And you're assuming everyone is either dating or
mm-hmm.
in a relationship or, you know, just it's out for, you know, wanting sex.
Yeah.
But what about the asexual?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, damn, I knew I was going to leave out somebody, but it's always that... I think students are actually really great for pointing out
what we're missing.
Yeah.
The fact that they are 18, 19, 20, and I'm not saying all of them, and I'm not going to assume about all of them, but that there is a general acceptance that sex is an occupation like that. Like, I've never had to convince the students that sex is an occupation.
Neither have I.
They just agree.
They're usually
pretty
happy. They're usually pretty like excited that...
That's
well, shocked one that I mentioned
yeah.
it. Like,
well, you
because
know,
no one expects your teacher to bring
well,
that up on
you know,
like,
that
day
is,
one.
But you know who says it's not an occupation?
A couple people. A lot of people.
Kielhoffner.
Oh, interesting.
I mean, not anymore. But like he said in the text, sex is an occupation because it's for survival and procreation, which makes me think he had a bad sex life. But
because yeah, we
wow.
know.
That's why I always
yeah,
bring
no.
that up in class
oh, wow.
to make sure that people know that even though there's theories or
yeah.
leaders out
there,
there
are definitely people
don't
that don't think it's
gaps in
yeah,
knowledge.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But they're, I mean, with the age group of those students as well that they're coming in, they're much more exposed to different things than I would have been even
mm-hmm.
when I was a teenager, you know? So, I mean, they're coming in and they have, even if it's just a superficial understanding or a kind of an acknowledgement that there's something out there
yeah.
of even, like, gender identity or consent.
Well, even if you think the access
things,
to porn.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we do this thing at the end of the class where I show them there's a manual called Pleasure Able, mm-hmm. Pleasurable, yeah. You know, and we show pictures of that and there's different devices and we discuss what they are and the use of them. And then at the very end, I say, is there anything about these images that you want to critique or you notice? And like that, there's guaranteed maybe two or three of them. It's like, it's all men and women. It's like, yeah, it is. So gay men and gay women and anybody excluded. In between don't exist.
Yeah.
There's nothing there for them.
I was looking at that manual yesterday after you mentioned it. Yeah. And there's some interesting adaptive vibrator devices.
Yeah. Were you looking at it in session? Or just...
right out there. Right. Doing a shopping.
There was some shopping last night.
Yeah, we may have off of an Instagram sale where we were told there were vibrators. It was a bad
sale. It was a bad sale.
One thing I'm hearing about education programs, though, is that either we're not covering it very well.
It's like one way or the other.
We're doing one class, but I'm assuming that it's sexuality might be being touched on. In
pun intended.
Whatever. Pediatrics, young adults, older adults, yeah. Midlife, like developmentally, and I think it stops after my one class.
And mm-hmm. certainly for me, in terms of our students going out to practice, I get so disheartened when the only ones that have ever spoken about or approached the topic of sex is generally when they've worked with mostly people after, say, a hip replacement. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they give them a leaflet that shows them different mm-hmm. positions you can do after your hip replacement. And that's it. And that feels like
orthopedic or spinal cord.
Job's done. Yeah. You know the positions.
Here's
a pamphlet.
There's a pamphlet that's got really dodgy black and white drawings. Again, for men and women. That's it.
You know. And no talk. If you talk about like a hip replacement, there's got to be a lot of fear and the emotion involved with like, am I going to injure myself?
Yeah. It's all the health risks. Yeah. Not the pleasurable.
No, there's no pleasure. It's don't break your precautions.
I think we were talking about this the other night. I mean, the class is sexuality. We begin talking about culture and diversity mm-hmm. and the idea of not assuming everyone is the same as me. But the class, it starts off at sexuality broad and then goes into sex and gender identity mm-hmm. and breaks it down that way for them. But for the students, one of the key things that we get across to them is that even if you're talking about sex or sex life, for a lot of the clients, it could be even just the notion of intimacy
mm-hmm.
yeah. and that connection with their partner or with their own bodies mm-hmm. and nobody having that conversation with them. It doesn't have to be just the physical act of sex, mm-hmm. but just even romance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or holding hands, or expressing them. Exactly. Right.
Walking down the street, holding hands, giving a kiss.
Yeah.
We talked last night, just being able to stand up and give a kiss if you're normally, if you're in a wheelchair, like being that face-to-face level.
And the thing is, if we don't ask our clients, who is? Like, who else? Are we all assuming that other people on the team are talking about mm-hmm. this, or that they're talking to their partners about it, or do they have to go off and then pay for a private counselor to do this when we were well able to do this?
Or they're just struggling through
that. And we've talked about this before, too, that, you know, a lot of times the clients might be waiting for the practitioner to bring it up, and then
the professional waiting for
the client to bring it up, and then nobody brings it up.
Or they're not bringing it up because there's another ism there, which might be an ableism, with Owen and I, we talk a lot about sanism. So when you're working in mental health, mm-hmm. there's so many ways that we stop people from doing their occupations in mental health, let alone we don't want to think of them as sexual beings. Or we're trying to in the DSM are sexual diagnoses that people mm-hmm. have decided this is outside of the realm of normal,
like we're going to label you
that othering, making it other
being gay back in the day
even heterosexuality started out as a diagnostic term in the early 20th century mm-hmm. so even straight people I'm very sorry but you two were diagnosed.
Everybody needs a label.
Labels for everyone. Yeah.
Let's make the DSM the flip. So whoever hasn't been diagnosed.
Yeah, you get one. It's your turn.
So I think it seems like sexuality in some respect has informed everyone's research interests.
Yes. Yeah.
Who wants to talk? Who wants to start? Probably you, because you're...
I don't know.
Yeah,
because I don't think you can stay around for this whole conversation.
No, I can't. I started off, actually, for my own master's research, looking at sexual orientation and kind of lived experience and how it can impact people's occupations, basically. Yeah. And what I found was the impact was not necessarily an effect, but rather lots of barriers. So barriers to things like wanting to be a parent, for instance, or barriers to getting a job they wanted because they, for some reason, were known to be gay or whatever. Mm. Barriers to going to places socially, barriers to feeling safe and things like that.
Yeah.
And then I continued on the theme of kind of thinking about, moving that to thinking about older people's experiences. I did some work with Lee Price. Do you know Lee Price?
Mm-hmm.
And he's now at Brighton, where I'm going to be going to actually. And we looked specifically at older gay people's experiences because of the history, certainly in the UK, and it's kind of similar in other countries, of having to fight basically for the right to even, you know, be acknowledged that you can be in a same-sex mm-hmm. relationship,
yeah.
but the complete struggle to get to that point for
mm-hmm.
them, and how now that has played out in their lives in terms of being in, for instance, a residential kind of care home or something like that, where your partner might be still living wherever in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Do they feel able to come and see you as the partner? You know, I've had that a lot in hospital, like partners coming and people assuming it's their brother or something like that.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, talking about that, and then my PhD was obviously in terms of woman-to-woman sexual offending, so that really touched on lots of issues around sex, sexuality, sexual orientation and sexual identity. I had two trans respondents amongst my all of my respondents, so lots of different stories and issues and everything
mm-hmm.
coming up within that, really.
Okay. And then in terms of, I mean, there's the theme of the conference is
yeah.
the dark side of occupation,
yeah.
which a term you coined, but you had nothing to do with the conference.
No.
So no. That idea of dark side of occupation, how would you relate that to sex?
Like I've really been trying to clarify here, the dark side of occupation to me was, you know, come on, let's talk about the things that we've not been talking
mm-hmm.
about. And those things are, like I've just said, really, that's why I wanted personally to look at those
mm-hmm.
aspects of human
mm-hmm.
experience, because from an occupational perspective, it hadn't really been fully addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know that sex had not been, well addressed, but had been ignored.
Mm-hmm.
So it was along those lines of the ignored, the kind of, you know, the things that are kept silent, invisible, or,
mm-hmm.
or you know, things that we're not really comfortable talking about. So,
mm-hmm.
Go. Because even to say on that, like, I know sex and sexuality is kind of the main thing, but even
mm-hmm.
I presented at the conference this week about death and dying
mm-hmm.
and breaking down that taboo of
mm-hmm.
having those conversations, and we do that in college.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there's lots of different things,
yeah.
and it's nice to see and to talk and meet other people
yeah.
who are passionate about breaking down those barriers and talking.
Talking
about
the uncomfortable things.
Yeah.
And for me, the key part of it always is that we're normalizing conversations but not trivializing the
mm-hmm.
experiences.
Right.
And I think, and we have found, JJ and I have found, like, the more we talk about it, I don't care anymore who I'm talking to. I've lost.
We don't care about talking to you either.
Sorry.
There's like no filter anymore.
No filter.
Yeah.
Any stigma I had attached to talking
yeah.
about sex, anything related, it's gone. And it is as simple as talking about it in an open,
mm-hmm.
honest
yeah.
forum that it takes away that stigma and makes it just a more comfortable,
mm-hmm.
everybody just needs
everyday conversation.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
With my family, friends,
anybody who wants to listen, really.
They're used to it now. How about your research on?
So my research, like I was saying, so my PhD is on the lived experience of transgender people in Ireland. And the reason I came around to doing that, I suppose, was that, well, I identify as a gay mad man, essentially. So mad studies is very important to me, something
mm-hmm.
that I'm passionate about, and then being gay, well, that wasn't something I chose, but it's something that
mm-hmm.
I, you know, that I live with. But a couple of years ago in Ireland, we were having the referendum on marriage equality, and like, I grew up in the 80s where, you know, you would cross the street because the man walking towards you was funny,
mm-hmm.
you know, that kind of way, and like, there was that equation between paedophilia and homosexuality,
mm-hmm.
and it was just,
mm-hmm.
they were wrong and
yeah.
bad and othered and all that kind of stuff. So then I dealt with all that when I was growing up, and then I came out late in life. I came out in my late 20s,
mm-hmm.
and then I met my now husband, and when the referendum was happening, I struggled with what was going on and people having conversations about me. And again, it was this
yeah.
thing about people talking about
yeah.
me again, and I was
yeah.
just so tired of that. But when the referendum was happening, I started to notice that there was more and more conversations about trans people. So, I mean, Laverne Cox from Orange is the New Black, she appeared on the Time magazine. And there was just seemed to be this kind of moment happening where there was more and more representation occurring. And then I was reflecting on my own experiences as a gay man and how I was affected occupationally and the things that I wanted to do and felt afraid to do, or the things I would dream about. Like, I mean, I've known I wanted to be a dad since I was a teenager, and I'm still kind of worried about, well, if I pursue that, is it fair in a kid who's going to be bullied because they have two dads? You know, all this kind of stuff. So then I tried to equate, well, if I'm feeling this way and I'm being othered, how do trans people feel, and how are they affected occupationally? So then that's how I got into that area. And like the whole thing about the intersectionality between madness and gender identity and sexuality and all those things that come together in a really beautiful way for me, really. So that's how I got into that, my area of study.
Fantastic. Moving on over.
So dating has always been one of my favorite occupations, and I happened to get married, and so it stopped, unless I want to be having an affair, and I might bring it back, so to keep my marriage together, I'm nosy, and I'm trying to find out about everybody's dating life. And
you did my proxy.
I think dating is so fascinating. So multiple experiences clinically where people would bring up dating, either like polyamorous dating, or if they were gay, how they would start dating, or... But I realized when I moved to Ireland, it was like going back in time, in that online dating had just started, in a way. Like Tinder had hit in 2012, and all of a sudden, this occupation was rapidly changing based on the introduction of technology, and the culture itself was changing. And I just thought, I could study this occupation in a moment, and I think it would tell something about occupations in general. Like, it's not just about dating. So I'm studying the experience for straight, young Irish women living in urban areas of Ireland.
How did it end up being Ireland?
When you are from somewhere else, you see that people do things differently, and you find that more interesting. So I was really curious in the form, function, and meaning of dating, and challenging my own assumptions. So even when you're doing research, often you address your own bias or reflexivity by writing your own story. So I had to write my own dating story, which I know you want a copy of.
Absolutely. Can we put that on the website?
Yeah, but I have my own judgment. So I'm dating, coaching women in Ireland, and they're like, I don't know if I'll go online. I'm like, well, you fucking better go online. I'm like, how are you gonna? But I can't say any of that. But I'm like, you're not online. I've been online since 1998. What are you doing? You know? Like, holding back. There's reasons that I'm online because one of the findings that I'm finding is called mortified. That they're mortified. They can't say. Of somebody catching them on an online date, like their friend coming in and like, I have to introduce this person.
Because there's a whole stigma,
and it's so,
which is fascinating because it's so common online dating, yet there is still such a stigma
about
how you met.
Let's come up with a story about how we met. Like, what's that going to be? It can't be, hey,
or
we met on Tinder.
I'll turn off Tinder when I'm home because I don't want matches coming up in my hometown. So it's really like this
people
fear.
Seeing or knowing. Yeah.
I need to be 20 miles away from my house.
I think it's interesting as well that the fact that you were doing it in Ireland as an American in Ireland, right?
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to identify differences in ways of doing when there's an obvious difference. Like, let's say between ethnic groups or age groups, right? And the fact that you're a tall, blonde, white, straight woman in Ireland, where the majority is still white, you know, that you could make, very easily make that assumption that, well, everyone's just like me, and everything is done the same way as me. So by exploring a group that is culturally, you know,
different.
Similar, but different, and
like
uncovering
like
those
what differences
doing.
Did you see?
So I'm the same age, they're straight, I'm from an urban area, but it was just the culture. So the difference, I mean, just that part about being mortified, the cultural aspect. We asked about their history of dating, how their parents met, how their grandparents met, how they saw dating. So it was just more that storytelling of my parents met in the same town, my grandparents met at the parish hall dance. It was just these stories that they had about how they thought they would meet someone. And then they're trying to negotiate now, well, am I traditional or am I modern? Like, I don't want to do this online dating. It's almost like they're forced to because they want to meet someone naturally. But they know it's also not going to possibly happen. They have to do something. So they're torn.
So do you think there's more of a stigma in Ireland than the United States for the online dating?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because of that traditional...
I think there's a help-seeking aspect to it, I think, a little bit, too, that they thought people would think they're desperate, that they needed help
Okay.
Through an app to get somebody. They still won't do online. Like Match.com is the number one still over Tinder in the U.S. Mm-hmm. It's a paid site. It's only like $15 a month. They won't do pay in Ireland.
Oh, interesting.
Nobody would like. I mean,
I'm not paying for that.
Which is quite the prostitution.
Or, yeah, I'm not paying.
But that would be more desperate.
Yes.
So it's like, well, it's a free app. And apps are kind of like a game. But, and then there's matchmakers. So they do have a matchmaking.
That's really interesting, though. Back to what you just said, that it's like a game.
It feels like a game. It's not.
Yeah.
And maybe you're not even actually participating in dating. You're just swiping it.
You're just swiping.
But you're never actually going on a date. So maybe it's a pre-dating or like an exploratory.
Exploratory dating.
Yeah. So then I found stages of dating. So there's like pre-dating activities, which could be searching online, getting ready, going out with your friends, like. It's kind of these pre-things, mm-hmm. then there's meeting somebody, so either like online or in person, and then there's like your first meetup or date.
Yeah.
And then there's once commitment happens, dating ends. Dating. So that's what they said, but although in Krishnagiri's research on mate selection, her stages continue till marriage. But my business felt like once you're in a committed relationship, you're just doing things together, you're doing co-occupations, but you're not dating. Your mate. So, like, does dating have, like, a shelf life? Like, it kind of ends when you commit.
Interesting point. And so then when we talk about, like, date nights with spouses,
like, are you
and
dating?
Like that,
or are
is
you...
it? Yeah. Yeah. And what does that mean? And what is the definition of dating then?
Mm-hmm.
That's
yeah, so then with,
concept.
Like,
yeah.
the doing of dating, like, when does it end? When does it stop? And a lot of them, when does it stop? When they ghost me. You know, or, like, it's not even a clear definition.
Doing ghosting
is an occupation. That would be a whole other. So then, but then you mentioned coaching too, dating coaching.
Yeah.
So how?
And because I was doing dating coaching practice, so I started doing that first. I realized I don't know what dating is in this culture. I need to do research and find out what it means for the people that I'm coaching. So that's why I started doing the research to inform the coaching. Yeah. So. Dating coaching is super fun. It's very. I don't live in an office because I feel like you have to meet people where dates happen. So I say dress up like the date. You're meeting a stranger for the first time, so it's kind of like go to the bar, the coffee shop you would go to on a Tinder date.
You get that dating satisfaction now, don't you?
Oh yes.
That vicarious.
Just touch me on the leg when I say something funny. No, I don't get that stuff. But yeah, and then we talk about a lot of it's not as occupation based because I can't date, we can't do the dating on there as a third wheel kind of thing, but it's more occupation centered. I help people create online profiles, taking pictures of them doing their favorite occupations. So it's like building an occupational profile online instead of just what picture makes me look the best.
Yeah,
like here's me in front of a theater with like tickets to a show because I love the theater.
Mm-hmm. Ah.
So like kind of creating
like
that.
And then would you plan out, like, I mean, okay, so we all have kind of scheme of how things are going to go, plan it out on our head, and so would you do that with them? Would you sit down and think, how do you think the date's going to go, or what do you envision happening, and what's the worst case scenario?
Yeah, and really going with their values and their goals. Yeah. So some people want a relationship, some people don't. They also, by the way, did not feel that one night stands was dating.
What was it?
Sex.
Just
so they did different.
Leisure activity.
So you can have a one-night stand that turns into dating. But
dating
when you have an intention of seeing them again and a possibility that it could be something. That's what
or
they said.
Is it boredom? Do you know, because even going back to the whole thing, like with sex, right? Like sex is okay, yeah, it is pleasurable, but sometimes it's just pure boredom or stress relief as well. You know, like, I mean, the endorphins when you masturbate and everything else, and then you come, and then, yeah, you feel great, and it was, you know.
Well, and there's, yeah, so I've started on social media for OT After Dark Masturbation Monday, and I've been trying to post things, but there was the most recent one I actually regrammed from Hot Octopus, but they were pointing out all the health benefits of masturbation, which had anxiety, depression, like, it had to do with all of those things.
So if we recognize those things, right, and then we're still putting people into locked wards in open bays that have no privacy, and then we're wondering why they need sedation and everything else.
And not even locked wards, we have teenagers in these school settings.
Yes, yeah.
Where they have no privacy, again, and they're maybe in a group home or in school, and they have no privacy, and everyone's telling them to not touch themselves. Like, somehow saying, don't touch yourself is going to eliminate the need
rather
to touch yourself.
Positive spin. Okay, well, you don't touch yourself in school,
but there's a private place.
You know, a private place in areas that you can do it, and where it's healthy and beneficial. And
so... Okay. What research do you think is needed in terms of sex as an occupation?
Where do we go?
Okay, so I'm going to be biased and say anything that's not straight. Because, I mean, that's been done to death.
Yeah,
you know?
I agree.
No, I shouldn't say that, because I'm sure there's still things about straight sex that are hidden or dark or need to be uncovered or talked about. I mean, within the dating world, you know, you hear like these phrases like vanilla sex or mild to wild.
Mm-hmm.
So what's going on in wild? Like, what's the wild sex? Like, we know about BDSM.
Because wild for one person is different
exactly,
for somebody
right.
else.
Right.
But so it's more so about that and just, again, normalizing it, not trivializing it, but
yeah.
finding out, like, what are the people's kinks out there? What are different fetishes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what happens and what are the meaning behind them, and just opening up that kind of worms and just laying it all out there and saying, yeah, this is what's going on.
This is the reality
yeah,
of
you're not a
sex
freak.
In the world.
There's plenty of people out there who feel
yeah.
like, or maybe you want to be a freak. Maybe you identify as that. That's great. You know? Get your freak on kind of thing.
Yeah. You do you.
You
yeah,
too.
Do you? Do you freak out? but aside from that, then, I think that stuff like demystifying asexuality.
Yeah.
Or even... creating devices for people that we don't necessarily see as sexual, like older people or people who have physical disabilities, or even understanding the mechanics of gay sex. Or do you know what, actually, I think what needs to be done is to familiarize yourself as an OT with the sexual orientation
yes.
and gender identities that you don't identify
yes.
as.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the sex acts that come with all of these different...
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, because... We should. There's one thing within transgender research that I came across quite early in my research journey was the idea that trans people had to be the educators for the medical professionals
mm-hmm.
or the healthcare professionals, and they were coming in and telling them, "Look, this is what you need to know about me," and this is, and that gets exhausting.
Yeah.
It should not be that way. It should be that we have somebody come in and we can be honest and say, "Look, I don't know much about your life, but I'm going to go find out." Or even before they come in, just read up, like go, like read about everything.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be. I worked somewhere for a while where I was the person, if someone came in who was gay or transgender or anything
yeah.
other,
yeah.
I was the person that got assigned that
yeah.
client because...
You didn't even know it was that person.
I was the person that was accepting and open-minded, and I was fine with that, but I'm thinking, why isn't the entire department
yes. why
that
is it left
person?
To one person? Like
yeah.
yeah.
So
yeah.
also, when I talk about doing dating coaching, it's like, well, I couldn't do that. I need a specialty. And I'm like, well, I don't know how to cook, but nobody's going to
yeah.
say I can't totally leave a cook now, right? Like, it's okay. I actually think one of the frustrations is that OTs don't know how to date or
yeah.
they're really open about their sexuality, and they think they have to have those skills. And it's like,
you need interviewing skills is what you need. You need to be
yeah.
able to ask questions and figure out.
Their sex
yeah.
life, they're dating. So like, I can't come with all of my skills, which I have many. Obviously.
All I heard you say was, I can't come is all I heard you say. I'm sorry. Was there something after I can't come?
With all the skills that you have.
Yes. So many. We just have to adapt. Maybe we can get you some adaptive equipment to help you come.
Yeah.
But even I was thinking there as well when you were talking about dating.
Yeah.
That before I met my husband and I started going out dating, and it became this kind of it was an occupation, but the goal wasn't to meet someone and fall in love. It was more so just to get comfortable in dating and
mm-hmm.
being seen outdoors and
yeah.
getting into that habit of talking to men and how to date and how to flirt and you know all those
mm-hmm.
kinds of things. I got so good at it. I used to have like a kind of a routine essentially. Like there was a specific bar that I would go to, and there was a specific corner because the lighting was just right. It wasn't too bright, it wasn't too dark. You know, all this kind of stuff. The music was low. And the thing about it was, though, that if the date was going well, there was a place we could go nearby and carry on and have more fun. If it wasn't going well and I wanted to call it quits, there was a very open area.
You were an
area
expert.
Space. I was like, let's walk up this way. And then I could turn around and say, okay, goodbye now. And they were going to try and lean in a public space or, you know.
So that's something that we actually plan. It's
yeah.
sometimes we plan the temporality of a date is how long it's a date
yeah.
for you. Which
oh,
you
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
And what's the post option or not? Like to plan
yeah.
like... If you have the thing to do afterwards, like, oh, actually, you know what? Let's go. I have this cool new bar that I know
yes.
in the client, and you
yeah.
are like one bringing them to that or something.
Yeah. Or your friend who was scheduled
yeah.
to ring you an hour into the date, and you can go, no,
yeah.
it's okay. Or, yeah, yeah, oh, I have to go.
I gotta go.
Yeah.
By the way, that bartender
yeah.
knows your game.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what's that guy? It's like, same outfit. All right, 8 o'clock, Karen.
think that's the part of it. It's like it's not getting it across to people that it's not something that comes naturally or easily. Mm-hmm. It's like anything else. It's a skill. Like some people obviously might be very good at it. Like Karen was saying, she's got math skills. And, but like for a lot of people as well, it could be just like any other occupation or skill that we learn and we have to practice and mm-hmm. develop at it.
But it's an interesting occupation where a lot of people, actually every person I talked to did not want to do it, but felt that they had no choice. But then I said, well, what if dating didn't exist? Yeah. And I just gave you your perfect person. But they still said, well, no, I'd still want to date them to get to know them. So it's almost like job interviewing. I'm trying to think of another occupation where you feel like I have to go through this process, although I don't want to. It's the end. So that's why the meaning and the function at the end.
I was just
going to
say, it's
really
like, what is the purpose of the occupation?
Shopping for the perfect dress.
Yeah.
Hate it. Don't want to do it.
Yeah.
Got to travel.
Whereas other people just want to shop and not get the dress.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Just
right.
The exploring. And you're like, I just would order this online if I could. Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's it. So what is the purpose of the occupation? It's like, what is the purpose of the dating? Is it
to
go out and have fun? Is it to go out and maybe have sex? Or there was a woman I knew years ago when she was a student. You know, student life can be rough. So sometimes money was tight. And it's not going where you think I'm going with this. She used to go on dates just to get dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so she would like, I'm very happy to have a man pay for me to have dinner. And, and that was it, you know?
Well, one of the things that came out from the participants I had, which in a way we're looking for relationships and or like a lifetime partner, so that's a skew and a bias, but that the function was to find a partner to do things with in life and share things with. So I thought, the function is actually to find someone to do occupations
with.
So it's an option to find an occupational partner. And even if you're not doing it with
them, you are. This goes back to like
the
living in the matrix theme here.
Meta
dating.
To get you to have a partner in occupation. Not a partner in life, a partner in occupation.
Occupations.
That came out of that. But,
Oh, that's deep.
But then we also studied bereavement for spouses. There was a capstone group at my school. And one of the losses was, I don't have somebody to do this with anymore. So now with dating, I'm also thinking about the flip side of loss of partner or breakup.
You've lost that person to do occupation with.
Like maybe the worst part is, I don't know what to do on my Sunday anymore. We used to go to the farmer's market. Or who am I cuddling? Like you're using an occupation. And it's hard to quit any occupation, like smoking or something else. And you're like, well, what do I replace this?
That's how they
equal your
greater
value.
Yeah.
Oh, so much to think about.
Yeah.
we can kind of close up here. Any final thoughts? Any last things you desperately want to say about sex, dating?
I don't really want to say that I have a final closing remark because then that kind of like ties it all up.
Yeah.
I don't think there's a way to tie it up. No.
You know, or something to think about. You know, not like what's the final thought, but like, you know, you posed that great question about
what should we
replace an occupation. So
I think to think about sex on a sexuality spectrum, that it's how you're expressing gender identity, it's how you're enacting intimacy, sexual acts, thinking about what you want in the future as like a partner. It's just being really open that this is actually, people laugh when they hear I do dating coaching. Like, it's like a fun thing. Like, oh my God, that's so funny. And you're like,
isn't that fantastic?
Probably the most important thing, like who you end up with or what relationship you have.
Right.
And so, like, really taking that seriously, that it's everywhere. Like, we all are experiencing some kind of sexuality or sexual practice.
There's one thing I suppose that I would say as a kind of a closing remark, is that, and it is something that I teach to my students. So I said that we start with talking about like culture and diversity and all that kind of stuff, you know. And in the literature, it used to talk about cultural safety and then cultural competency. Mm-hmm. But then it was moved on to like cultural humility.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would say to my students is, if you're uncomfortable with the sexuality or the identities of the client who's sitting across from you, I don't care. Right?
Yeah.
You need to check that when you're
sitting
across
from them. Check it at
the door. Exactly. Yep. So it's not so much that you have to be competent in every single thing that you're going to come up against when you're an OT, but it's to show humility when you're sitting across from somebody. I think that's a perfect ending.
To end.
Thank you guys so much for being with us today.
Cheers.
We hope you enjoyed our little menage a cinq.
Our little global menage a cinq. I sure did.
It was a great time.
Everybody remember, sex is an ADL.
Cheers!